want to talk about that briefly.
Yes, the police seized in evidence, Michael has a baseball cap collection where he has 20 or more baseball caps. Three of them were red, and the police seized the three red baseball caps as evidence of gang affiliation. They also went in his closet and found some maroon t-shirts, and they said that that was gang colors. They took that. They found one's, I guess it was your younger brother's science project.
Yeah.
And they had a note from the teacher saying that this was a science project. The police seized this. They called it a spud gun and said that that was some sort of weapon that and evidence of gang affiliations. They found under Michael's bed, they found some nunchucks that he had gotten back when he was about 12 or 13 years old. He had been into the Bruce Lee and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles phase many a year ago and had gotten these nunchucks, and he would just play with them as a child. They'd been gathering dust under his bed for 10 years. The police pulled them out and said that that was evidence of gang activity. Also, they found Michael had a whole bunch of photographs up in his house of family members, his dog, his friends at school, and of a, probably about 100 photos up there. The police seized two. In one, there was one of Michael's friends was putting his hand in front of his face because whoever the photographer was, he was trying to block the shot. And so in putting his hand in front of his face, the police said he was giving a gang sign.
He even had his feet up in the air, kind of like blocking it. He was sitting down on the table, like, it totally didn't even look like a gang picture, but they made it seem like a gang picture.
And then the other picture was from his senior prom, and one of Michael's friends was making a signal with his hand, the police said was a gang sign. It just can't, you know, all of these absolutely circumstantial so-called pieces of physical evidence, if you add everything up together, it does not add up to gang violence. In fact, Maria, Juan's mother, complained that they accused him of being a member of the Norteño gang, and she explained that because of where she and her family are from in Mexico, that if they were part of any gang, it would be the Sureños, and that the police were showing their cultural ignorance at making that charge.
So, Juan, any comments on what Becky said? Is she anything you want to add or anything you want to correct to that?
No. What she was saying is that, like, since, you know, we're from Mexico, that we should be Sureños, not Norteños. That's the way the gang is. If you're, like, from, you know, United States, you're a Northsider, but if you're from Mexico, you're, you know, two Northsiders and 13ers. And that's what my mom's saying. So, like, if he should be anything, it should be a, you know, Sureño, because, you know, we're Mexican, but that's not the issue here. I mean, we're not gangs. Like, the way they were making it, they're trying to seem that they're really educated in gangs when they know nothing about them. Galante has, like, a couple hours, like, logs in gang, talking to gangsters or something, and now he's an expert. No expert. He's never even been around like gangs. No, we were raised around them, and we never joined them or nothing. And he's trying to make my brother seem like a gangster. I mean, look, he was what, 23 years old, had no criminal record, juvenile or, you know, as an adult. But yet they make him seem like a total criminal, gangster, and he's totally just a mean guy. And my brother's a totally nice guy.
What do you hear from your brother? How's he doing?
He's doing all right, I guess. They're telling you, he was saying that really dirty. He says it's kind of like, I don't know, he just said it. He's doing all right, not to scare my mom, but...
He's in San Quentin now?
He's in San Quentin. And he wrote us a letter saying that the gangsters are coming up to him telling him that if he wants to get, you know, affiliated and stuff, he can join up with them, and if he wants to meet anybody, it's just...
So ironically, what they're doing is they're pushing into a position where he's being pressured to join a gang, right?
Exactly. They were telling him that, you know, that he can get hooked up if he wants to get, you know, affiliated.
Now, does your family need defense fund money? I mean, I take it you're not, money isn't growing on trees for you.
It would help.
So I'm going to invite callers who have checkbooks and then money, and I don't know how many of us that is, to write a check. Who should it be written to?
I guess my mom.
Yeah, that would be Maria Gutierrez.
That's G-U-T-T-I-E-R-E-Z, is that correct?
Yeah.
Well, it's one T, isn't it?
It's G-U-T-I-E-R-R-E-Z.
Sorry, 1T1R, G-U-T...
Two R's.
G-U... You better...
G-U-T-I-E-R-R-E-Z.
That's Maria Gutierrez. And can they call you to talk to you about the situation, or would you rather not? Would you rather that they talk?
They've given their number out.
Okay. So why don't you give out your number one, and again give out your address for people to write and call if they're concerned about this case.
All right. Our number is 479-4233, and address is 2245 South Rodeo Gulch, and that's in California. Area code is 95062.
And repeat the phone number, could you, Juan?
It's 408 or
831.
831 now. 479-4233.
479-4233. And I'm also going to invite callers to call into our show now. We're gonna leave you on, and we're gonna leave you, Becky, so other people can use this line to give their reactions to what they've heard. And I encourage you to stand by your radios, both of you, and if questions are asked that I can't answer, then perhaps you can call back and let people know what you think of what's being, you know, discussed, or answer any questions that we can't answer here.
Sure, I'd be glad to.
Would you be willing to do that, Juan?
Yeah.
Anything you want to conclude with?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Just, you know, any kind of support I can get from anybody, we can get from anybody, would be appreciated.
All right.
I also wanted to add that the Holy Cross Church community has been extremely supportive of the Gutierrez family. Father Mike Marini, it has come forward, is being one of the people that is very concerned about this case. And also, one cannot help but wonder if there were some political motivations with these charges against Michael, since all of this planning for the beach area redevelopment was in the wind when all of this was going on, and the Gutierrez family is such a staunch presence in the Beach Flats community, and represented a family who could pose a lot of opposition to that plan. There are those who feel that the Gutierrez family was sidetracked by this, you know, attack on Michael.
Well, thank you, Becky, and thank you. We've been talking to Becky Johnson and Juan Gutierrez, and please call in now to 427-3772 if you have any comments or questions, or just what do you think about this? Is this another case of what we call an attic attack? Judge Robert Attic, thing it down.
Make sure I'm not lying alone there. Ramming it down our throats. In fact, I guess ramming it down the Gutierrez family's throats, unless you want a more colorful metaphor, which doesn't take much imagination to create. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Robert Norris. Our phone lines are open, 427-3772. If anything you've heard has disturbed you, if anything you've heard has made you want to speak out on this issue, or perhaps you know of similar cases that are going on, we need to know about this. The community needs to know about this, because the real power lies not in the politicians and in the judges. The ultimate power is with us here in the community. We can change. We can rectify the injustices that these institutional oppressors have created.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I just got back in from church, so I didn't hear your
what you've been talking about, except I understand you're talking about Miguel Gutierrez right now.
That's correct.
I was there at the sentencing of Miguel Gutierrez, and I seen some pretty shocking things in courtrooms, but I must say the Judge Addict's behavior is one of the worst I've seen any judge in a democracy.
What disturbed you about his behavior, caller?
Well, particularly, even before the sentencing started, the way he was treating his courtroom, he was obviously needed a fix or needed a drink or needed something. He was a real grouch anyway. Just the way he treated his own court, it was with a lot of disrespect. But then when the Gutierrez family and people from the Beach Flats came into the room, they came into the, when it was time for the sentence, they came into the room with their heads bowed and quiet and sat down in their seats quietly, and he yelled at them, "This is not a street corner, we're not just gathering around here, you know, this is a courtroom." I mean, this is not a street corner to me is a racist kind of a connotation where any, where two or more Chicanos might gather, you know.
It should be said that Judge Addict is a Caucasian, right?
I would say he's pure Aryan.
Mm-hmm.
I was really shocked at the type of behavior. To hear, and then when Sima Kenyatta came forward to speak, trying to tell...
And Sima Kenyatta, of course, is an African-American.
And yes, African-American, but also has worked with you know, Parks and Recreation and with the Loudoun Nelson Center and knows boys on the street and knows who the good boys are. And he knows that Miguel Gutierrez's family, and Miguel Gutierrez specifically, was very anti-gang in the Beach Flats and was very, very outspoken and took a lot of flack from a lot of other kids for being anti-gang. But Judge Addict would have none of this. Instead, kept challenging Simba's authority and his language and what I would say was only racist kind of attacks. Then when it came to the sentencing itself, to say that, you know, to add the 3 years for it being gang-related activity was so, and Judge Addict's reasons that he gave at the time of making that three years, was because of his having come from this party and having admitted, while he was incarcerated for 8 months, having admitted under one of those interrogations that he knew that a couple of people at that party had been gang members. Of course he knows who the gang members are, because he was against those gang members. He was anti-gang, and they got 3 years extra for having that knowledge. Three years extra. That Judge Addict is absolutely undefensible behavior, and I don't know how much he's politically connected with the Beach Flat development or whatever, but he certainly was well used by those power forces. And Judge Addict should not be a judge, and there should be an uprising in this community to get that man off the bench. It was disgusting behavior.
Now, there is, of course, an avenue to file complaints, not that they're ever listened to. That's the Commission on Judicial Performance.
Yes.
And if anybody's interested, please give a call to the Huff line. That's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom at 423-HUFF, and I'll try to give you details on how to reach the Commission on Judicial Performance. You can put on Addict's record that you think he's something of a black-robed scumbag for his behavior, sort of a racist character for this
he's
kind of stuff.
He's both unprofessional and very, 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 very transparent in his racism.
Mm-hmm.
Very transparent and very unprofessional at the same time. He fails on both scores. He should not be a judge. He should retire. He should have a drink, take a fix, whatever his problem is chemically. It's out of line, out of whack, and anyone should just go into his court and just watch one time and try not to come out vomiting.
I think that's Department 5.
Talk to you later, Robert.
Yeah, do call us back, caller. I recognize you. We're talking, of course, to David Silva, and we want to talk to you about other things.
Okay.
So stay tuned.
What's that number again?
Phone number here is 427-3772 for those of you who want to call in.
Okay.
And we'll be hoping to hear from you.
Indeed, 427-3772 is the call-in number. We have promised to play Phil Baer's take on the Beach Flats, since the Beach Flats seems to be kind of creeping into this conversation. We're going to be doing that shortly, but while you can, please give us a call if any of this is concerning you about this kind of judicial, what are you going to call it, tyranny, vindictiveness, racism, overreaction, politically connected mockery of justice. You know, interestingly enough, I know most of these judges personally in terms of casual encounters and, of course, professional encounters in court. I've been before a number of them, tried by a number of them. for so-called homeless crimes, such as sleeping at night and trespassing where we occupied property on behalf of homeless people and so forth. And, you know, I got nothing against them as people. They're, as far as I'm concerned, ordinary people, amiable people. I like to maintain good contacts with everybody. But you have to speak out about people and judge them in terms of what they do in their official capacities. And when judges engage in abusive behavior, as Judge Attuck did and is continuing to do, because presumably he can reconsider the sentence in the Michael Gutierrez case that we've been talking about, he has to be held accountable for what he does. He's ruining people's lives. You see this, of course, daily around the so-called drug war. A judge I like as an individual, Tom Kelly, I call him Kangaroo Kelly, and he and I are on very friendly terms. I saw him ruining people's lives sort of as a regular course of action the other day in court. In a probation case, a guy was up there for, it was cocaine. It seemed clear that there wasn't even evidence that directly connected him with the cocaine. So they found a bag of cocaine near him after he'd run away from a probation search. And there was no other evidence. There was testimony that other people ran away. There was by no means even a preponderance of the evidence. But of course, he didn't even have a trial on this. It was a probation hearing. And Kelly sentenced him to 4 more years in prison for a bag of cocaine nearby, with no fingerprints, no indication that it came from him, just circumstantial evidence. Again, the whole idea of drug war, sending people to jail, is to me vicious obscenity. It crushes families, it destroys lives, it corrupts police departments, it's all over the place. And I'd like to say that not a single one of our great city council candidates is saying a word about this issue, but all they're doing is pushing for a bigger police department here in Santa Cruz and praising the police, asking for more police and so forth. Just wrong-headed kind of stuff. You hear a lot of criticism of the police on this show because I don't like police states, and where police rule, where police make decisions, where police selectively enforce laws, where merchants turn loose the police like wild dogs on homeless people and poor people downtown, trained dogs actually, let's be specific, that's the kind of society that has to be changed, and that's what we're trying to do. Hopefully in this election, when we get 3 candidates elected who are seemed, as I said, to be, you know, curtailing their words, Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar, we can try to do something, and we're going to be talking about those people shortly. I promised a caller an hour ago we were going to look at their statements on the sleeping ban. Before we do, however, I do want to play Phil Baer, who has done an analysis of the Beach Flats group, the Beach South of Laurel plan, Beach Flats plan, I should say, because, as I said, there's been so much complacency and slapping on the back, and everybody's going to go home because they think the whole battle has been won. No, the only thing that's been won is for the conservatives, the issue of the Beach Flats has been removed from the election, partially with the candidate complicity, because the candidates have sort of played into this. They should not play into this. They should recognize the Beach Flats issue has not been removed. It's still sitting right there waiting to bite everybody in the genitalia once the election results are in. So let's hear an interview with Phil Baer about this. I'm going to wait a few more moments in case you want to comment further on the Gutierrez case. And I remind you, you can contact the Gutierrezes directly. I think I have their phone number here. I'm going to make sure I do. Looks like I don't. So perhaps we'll get that number again later in the show. But if you want to give me a call, after the show at 423-HUFF, I'll be happy to pass you their number so you can contact them directly and offer what help you can. We have an incoming call.
Yeah, I can give that number.
Go ahead.
For the Gutierrez family. It's 479-4233.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to mail those letters or even funds to help with the legal defense, mail those to Maria Gutierrez, 2245 South Rodeo Gulch, Santa Cruz, California, 95062.
Thank you, caller.
or I should say thank you, producer. Thank you very much, Becky, for giving that information out to the public. This is, of course, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Let's hear a little of what's been happening around the Beach Flats. I should say, what one seasoned observer finally is able to give us in terms of his evaluation once all the dust is settled from the October 6th, October 7th City Council meeting that seemed to have passed a so-called compromise. Let's hear what he says about that.
We have on the line with us Phil Baer, and Phil, you're a Beach Flats resident. You've been really almost single-handedly, well, not entirely, but some of us have been helping get people to, you got people to City Council who were the actual residents of Beach Flats on the 1st of October, and I think through such mobilizing of public opinion, you were able to at least forestall for the moment the worst elements of the Beach Flats boardwalk giveaway. How do you view that assessment?
Well, you're giving me too much credit, though. I appreciate it. Actually, the effort to organize the Beach Flats Latinos who were to be displaced by the Third Street realignment was led mostly by others, including Maria Gutierrez.
Roxana
Quistapache, certainly. Veronica Lopez was very influential, as was my wife, Jane Baer, and Jerry Quintero should be mentioned. Those were the people that just went down there and hung out and chewed the fat and built up the confidence and did much more of that than I did.
As usual, the women are doing all the work and
exactly. Quite interestingly, it felt very much like predominantly a woman's movement kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, oftentimes that's what happens. You know,
exactly. No doubt. Indeed.
The question I guess I have is that have you been talking to the residents since the October 7th early morning vote by City Council to produce the so-called compromise? I guess we must also mention that the compromise happened the day after 6 acres of million-dollar land, public land, Tidelands land, was given away by the City Council. Instructions to give it away were given to their negotiators. So that has to be discussed, and I certainly want to get a comment on that. But in terms of the Latino population of Beach Flats, the residents, both Latino and non-Latino, has there been any, do you have any, get any sense from them about how they feel the situation?
Well, of course, they were in the same position as the rest of us initially, had to spend some time waiting for the actual motion that came out of that meeting to come out so they could see what it look like in print, and then evaluating the very frankly tricky language that it involved. I hate to assume things about how other people reacted to it. Let me just talk how I am now thinking about it, having had a few days to actually study it.
The motion actually hit us on last Tuesday at the City Council meeting when Emma slipped into her office, gave me a copy. I gave a copy to Scott Graham, and I guess Scott copied up copies for the...
Yes. What strikes me as being almost deceitful, honestly, is the second part of the motion, if you'll recall, immediately starts talking about the Third Street realignment, the amusement park expansion, and the retail commercial space on the main beach lot will be addressed through a community-based process, clearly suggesting that these elements of the plan have not been pulled out of the plan at all. They've already arranged, directed staff is the wording, to directed staff to address through a community-based project, which as they later define it, really becomes a rather amorphous and meaningless term, to bring these things back to the council in short order. So by no stretch of the imagination have they been eliminated. And then I think it's in the third part of the motion where they most clearly talk about eliminating the Third Street expansion, the amusement park expansion, Third Street realignment, retail commercial outlet. those, I just realized, only are added to the adoption of the so-called reduced commercial alternative variant, as that's described. In other words, they have this alternative proposal, which is one of the, I think, six alternatives that are analyzed in the environmental impact report, and from this sixth alternative, the reduced commercial alternative, which they pulled in at just the last minute in response to a lot of public outcry, from that alternative, they also add this language that deletes the expansion. In other words, these projects, the alignment and the expansion and the retail commercial on the main beach, are just eliminated from an alternative variant. They are not eliminated from the plan itself.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. And have you kind of consulted with others? Do they agree with you on your assessment of it?
Well, I don't know that anybody has a definitive interpretation. You can look through these several pages of motions and addendums and find stuff that seems to me to be very confusing and contradictory, but those are the motions right off the top, and I don't see anywhere where they say that these things are eliminated from either the beach area south of Laurel Comprehensive Plan itself, which seems to exist exactly as it existed originally. Not one word is really changed in the BSAW plan itself, nor are they eliminated in terms of the EIR. The EIR still analyzes the full 4 acres of amusement park expansion, 433 new residential units within the project area, 588 new hotel-motel rooms within the project area, and 414,315 square feet of additional retail commercial space within the project area, with 162 possible lost housing units. All of that is exactly the same in the EIR. Any amount of loss of housing units or additional new units or additional new hotel units or amusement park expansion that does not exceed those numbers is in fact covered by this EIR. And it always was, still is, and nothing in that little sleight of hand that occurred two Tuesdays ago alters the basic plan at all.
So, I know that Keith Sugar, an attorney who is running for city council and an attendee at this city council meeting, was himself not convinced that the so-called substitute Hernandez motion, which you are referring to, the final proposal passed 7-0 by the city council, was, when he was examining it, that it didn't in fact allow for a very rapid passage of this entire plan, including all the elements people don't want, Third Street realignment, a boardwalk expansion, and commercial retail outlet, right after the election, if they get their one seat, one vote, one person elected.
Right.
Is that your understanding too?
Exactly.
What would be the time frame? Let's suppose Linda Steinau gets into power. She was endorsed today by the Senator of Sentinel.
Wasn't that a slap in the face?
No surprise.
No.
Walton.
The usual battle lines are drawn.
Right. What if one of these people is elected? How long will it take them to pass this, you know, to make the changes necessary? Do they have to hold a separate public process? Do they have to, you know, what do they have to do in order to...
It looks quite simple to me. Later on in the draft motion that you have and I have, which is, as I understand it, the clearest expression we have to date of exactly what has occurred here, later on, towards the last or next to last page, they sort of define what they mean by community-based project. The whole assumption, the optimistic, progressive interpretation was that this language about community-based process meant that these plans would at least be somehow taken back to the community for some sort of tangible indication of support from the residents. It seems to me, is wishful thinking. If you read that next to the last page where they talk about what the process will be, they talk about taking these ideas, Third Street realignment, amusement park expansion, and so on, back to the beach committee in coordination with service providers and other existing community resources. The beach committee is a city council subcommittee, three-member subcommittee, dominated rather obsessively by Hernandez and Kennedy, and then the service providers are social programs, staffers from social programs, all of whom are funded in large measure by the city.
Who's the third member of the committee?
Celia Scott, who just is repressed in those committee meetings much more ruthlessly than even she gets repressed on the council.
Do we know when the next committee meeting is?
They canceled the last three. Those committee meetings became rather weren't working, going in their direction, so they just stopped having them. Basically,
that's interesting. They canceled the last three. So the last such meeting was what, in April or something?
That's something like that. It's been a long time.
We know, of course, that two of those council members will be gone.
That's true.
Celia Scott and Kennedy are not going to be running again.
Right. So that will be, those two vacant seats will be filled by majority rule of the council. Again, it all hinges on the outcome of this election. But if, as you're suggesting, somebody like Steinau and or Cordero and or Walton, presumably, got in, then that would give them the 4-3 majority that would enable them to stick two of their people on that Beach Cups committee. So you're basically saying that you're redefining the term community-based process so as to mean city council-based process backed by people who are funded by the city council. I don't think it's anything close to what people like Gary Patton and Marty Wormhout and ourselves think of when we speak of community-based process, or when we point out that they don't have a project area committee involved in the redevelopment process. You know, where we're thinking about people who actually live in the damn area, the residents.
Well, you don't want to carry,
even mention.
You don't want to carry things too far, Phil. After
exactly.
All,
it's like, Big Brother knows best, but now we're calling Big Brother the community instead of Big Brother.
Okay.
So we have community-based rather than Big Brother-based planning.
So it's doublespeak, in other words.
Oh, I think it's just treacherous redefinition of terms so as to extract any possible meaning from those terms.
Well, let me ask you this then. Based on your understanding of the workings of city council, what's the soonest they can bring this back? And do they have to vote again as a council to put the Third Street realignment back officially into the plan, or is it already there? And
oh, I'd say it's definitely there. They talk about additional environmental study. As I understand, that stipulation could be met very easily through what's called a negative declaration. It's about a two-page thing that is absolutely superficial and routine. It could be, but you know, the basic lump of the first-tier EIR, the program-level EIR, that's all done. That means that any developer who wants to do anything in the whole damn project area, the scope of which does not exceed these rather grand allowable numbers, can come in, and the EIR is basically done. They tack on a little additional project-specific negative declaration that takes them about a week to do, and they've taken care of that whole EIR element already. So they've done, instead of doing the whole thing in one fell swoop, they're doing the EIR, which is a big lump of it. It clearly paves the way for these projects to happen quickly. And then they come back a little bit later with the actual proposal itself, which hasn't even been taken out of the plan. They don't even have to resubmit the proposal. It's already there, ready to go.
So
the ducks are lined up. It's flying.
So you're saying that in fact, after the election, all anybody needs to do is simply propose a, let's suppose I'm a developer who wants to proceed with the Third Street realignment. What's my time frame? When can I start bulldozing? What do I need to get done to start bulldozing?
Well, I can imagine them having a couple more of their bogus public hearings where the public sits around and endures 2 or 3 hours of staff promotion of the project so that they can say that the project has now been represented through a community-based process. But as far as I understand, there's absolutely no impediment to these things going forward. Nothing that's been done will slow these things down at all. All fast track.
Are any council votes required? In other words, I'm saying, I can understand what you're saying.
I think they would be required a council vote. They are assuming that they'll get a fourth person on that council and have a 4-3 working majority, and they can bring it back, and the council votes will be as routine 4-3 then as they have been 5-2 for the last 2 years. You know, that's all a little more than a formality if they get that fourth seat on the council.
So are we looking then at like a 2 weeks to a month lead time before the steamroller starts to steam?
It seems to me altogether possible.
Uh-huh. Now, it's interesting. I went through my last city council meeting. I spoke at length after having reviewed.
Yes, saw you on the tube. Very eloquent.
Thanks, Bill. I spoke at length after reviewing the last 2 hours of the city council meeting, of 5 hours of discussion on the Hernandez so-called compromise, and I found that time and time again, almost without exception, though not entirely, the two members of the council who had proposed their own alternatives, Celia Scott and Catherine Byers, were voted down or agreed to have their language removed or weakened.
Absolutely.
And I listed a whole series of issues on which that happened. Incidentally, Councilmember Rotkin came up to me afterwards and said that was not the case, and I characterized my speech as a series of lies, but of course, when I asked him what particular lie he would like to tear apart, he declined taking me up on that.
Of
topic.
Course.
So, why, in your opinion, did these two council members, Celia Scott and Catherine Byers, vote for this monstrosity if it is, as you say, simply a concealed blank check to proceed with the original project?
Well, you recall yourself that neither of them even had 5 minutes before the meeting to look at Hernandez's proposal to evaluate them, and it took me several days after I found them in print to start to see the sort of hidden language and understand exactly what they meant and what they didn't mean. Celia and Catherine, both of whom are highly intelligent, got no lead time at all. They just had to pick it up as the council meeting started and try to glance at it as the council meeting was proceeding. And I think got swept along the way most of us did with this talk, these phrases about elimination of the Third Street realignment, elimination of the amusement park expansion. It takes you a while to notice that they're only eliminated from an alternative to the EIR. They're not eliminated from the beach area plan itself. I think basically that they were sort of deceived, and I would hypothesize that maybe they now regret having supported the plan. I think they made a mistake.
Have you brought this analysis to them or to others on the beach area working group?
No, I haven't. I've just been involved in other matters, including the election, and then just real world stuff like paying the bills.
We're of course playing this live today on Sunday, the 18th. But I'm hoping that you will perhaps put this in a summary form on paper so that people could become aware of it. Because as you know, there is a universal sigh of relief and a kind of wave of complacency around this issue, a sense of victory and so forth. I, you know, have always insisted there's been no victory.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And I thought a letter to the editor yesterday from Bill Beebe really outlined very graphically exactly the little shell game by which we've been victimized here. And I think there's a growing awareness. The initial euphoria is wearing off, and everybody is realizing, hey, we've been in fact, the Sentinel editorial very clearly said, they can't refrain from letting the cat out of the bag, that this was, in fact, little more than an election strategy to pull the issues out from under the progressive candidates, the implication being that as soon as they win the election, all this stuff will be back on the table before you have time for breakfast.
For that reason, I think it's most important that you, in a concise form, put forward these clear thoughts so that, in fact, the issue now becomes clear it still is an election issue. In fact,
it is.
It always has been.
Yes, of course.
And, I mean, people do not have the clear sense of how little is actually done other than put the thing on 1 month hold.
Exactly.
I talked about this compromise being a compromise and I don't want to use the word sellout, but it certainly was a sellout when they sold the property earlier in the day.
No,
Yes, that was not a sellout. That was a giveaway.
Giveaway, exactly. I don't think any of us have the specific, articulated understanding that you have, and I would encourage you to put that forward in the community. Okay.
Thank you very much for the encouragement. I think it's definitely true. I'm very uneasy with the current state of things relative to this sense of having won something and somehow...
Let me ask you, are any groups such as the Beach Area Working Group actually meeting regularly, and have you brought this up at those...
Well, it's on... Yes. I think people there are beginning to mull over that motion and realize that it is not what they assumed it was, but people at that level are now concentrating mostly on the election itself. And it's increasingly difficult to generate enthusiasm about something like a legal challenge to the EIR. Everybody thinks that the EIR is now okay, or they're not quite ready to grasp that the EIR is basically as bad as it ever was. So it's a little difficult the wind has been taken from our sails in some of these matters. The Tideland thing is still hot, I believe, and other matters. But generally, there was this big, unjustified sigh of relief, like we'd won, and then a little sobering up period the next few days with people starting to realize, whoops, we didn't win, we've been snookered again.
It's been 2 weeks, and you're the first person I've heard who has actually discussed this. I've had some conversations with Beach Area Working Group people and others concerned with the beach flats, not in the Beach Area Working Group, and even those who have been critical of me and were engaged in that exclusionary stuff. Have been talking about the need for direct protests around the Tidelands area, forming a new group that might possibly be interested in going further around this. And I know you have. You're a member of a number of groups.
Yes, I'm trying to get together some sort of legal challenges. I feel like the Tideland thing was just ugly. And the EIR is... really even worse now than it was before, because the issue of what in fact it includes and doesn't include is muddier. EIR is supposed to specifically define what the project is so that you know what the significant environmental effects are and who the aggrieved persons are and all of this.
And that was community activist Phil Baer giving us, the first real analysis of the final Hernandez resolution as amended that passed City Council on October 7th that essentially gave the green light to Beach Flats giveaway. Apparently, even with the three major projects just ready to roll as soon as the election puts one vote back in process, one vote back on the council. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert. And a couple of historical notes today, as those of you will know who buy the Street Shit Sheet, the latest issue was published yesterday, issue 159, a fine publication, I might add. Give a call to 423-HUFF if you want to get your copy. Mary Fields was... And it's not quite clear she was born yesterday, but she's mentioned on the Heroes Sheroes, or actually Sheroes Sheroes calendar, and that's the calendar I'm often reading from and quoting from. Her real name was Mary Fields, but she was called Black Mary. She was a 19th century African-American pioneer, and I want to remember her today. At the age of 50, she was the second woman to drive a U.S. mail coach, the first woman in Cascade, Montana, to be granted the official privilege of drinking in the town's saloons, normally off limits to women. She hauled freight and did heavy chores, driving 8 horses, pulling 2 wagons. She single-handedly fought off a pack of wolves, shot a man who insulted her, started a restaurant that, and I think this is particularly significant, went broke because she insisted on feeding penniless travelers. And when bill collectors came, she knocked them flat into the streets when she was in her 70s. She stood 6 feet tall, weighed 200 pounds, often had a cigar clenched in her teeth, a jug of whiskey at her side, and a rifle and revolver at her hip. That's Mary Fields, also known as Black Mary. Another 19th century figure we might want to remember at this point is Sarah Emma Edwards.
Quote, I probably drew from my mother's breast with my daily food, my love of independence and hatred of male tyranny. She's an independent North American cross-dressing lesbian, inspired by a novel about a woman pirate captain. Sarah ran away from home at the age of 15, disguised as a boy, to escape being married off by her father. She worked as a bookseller in Nova Scotia and almost married a woman with whom she fell in love. She later joined the Union Army during the Civil War in male guise and fought 2 years undetected. While in no way did she desire to be a man, in fact, she had a natural antagonism toward men and felt that male society had mistreated her mother. And finally, let's also remember Sarah Winnemucca, or Thok Me Tony, who died October 16, 1891. She was a Paiute leader and outspoken critic of the treatment of Native Americans by the U.S. government. When she was born, her people were thriving in Nevada, but then were forced to relocate twice from a Reno reservation in 1860 to Oregon, and then brutally moved under starvation conditions to Washington. Sarah was able to get a presidential order for their return to Oregon, but the U.S. Army and reservation agents refused to enforce the order. She went on a national speaking tour deploring the treatment of her peoples and published an autobiography. Despite raising national awareness, she died without seeing the rights of her people restored. That's Sarah Winnemucca Thok Me Tony. So, my hat's off today to Sarah Winnemucca, Sarah Emma Edwards, and Black Mary, or Mary Fields, three women I want to remember, three fighters for freedom and for justice from the 19th century. Now, as promised, we're going to turn to a rather rough tape. Selections from the Downtown Association of October 15th. I hope we can hear it. Various questions were asked of the candidates, Sugar, Crone, Fitzmaurice, Walton, Quartararo, and Steinau. Neither Roden nor Pat Clark were there. In fact, Roden pretty much has disappeared into his hole, so to speak, on issues like the sleeping ban and downtown. Let's hear them as best we can as we run through the last 15 or 20 minutes of our show.
Okay, it's October 15th, 1998. This is the Downtown Association Forum Selected Cuts. Question about the sleeping van or the camping van, and Keith Sugar's response.
We support the camping van.